They were buying books madly. They had books stacked up in the basement of the Trinity College Library, just in windrows. Mm. They were furiously building their library. They had rebuilt Trinity College, and that's where I lived the first year and had classes. They were building that grand campus, the West Campus, on that grand design of an English university, really, with that Gothic limestone. There was a real fermentation there. There was a real stirring, intellectual and physical stirring. That was an exciting time to be there. My major professor was so busy building the library that I formed almost no real personal association with him. I never did, as a matter of fact. I owe a great deal to him.
Who was this?
William Kenneth Boyd. He was a man who never published much. He was too busy building the foundations for Duke University's history department. Mm-hmm. He was head of the Department of History. I came into association with some very interesting men. Boys, and one or two women. One of them became professor of political science and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois. Hmm. One of them went to University of Buffalo and was there, spent his whole career at the University of Buffalo. One of them spent a lifetime in the University of Chattanooga. Was at Emory University. At the University of Mississippi, Louisiana State, and Emory.
These are classmates of
these
yours?
These were classmates. Mm-hmm. And they went to, those boys and girls, Elizabeth Davidson spent her life in Coker College in Hartsville, South Carolina. They, that crop, I think, turned out pretty well. But my point, Taylor Parks, my roommate, was on the South American desk of the State Department, spent his career in the State Department. My point in mentioning this is that I was thrown into a vibrant atmosphere, not only with the university that was clamoring mightily to become a university, but I had stimulating associations with fellow graduate students.
Right. What professors did you find the most stimulating there?
I found my major professor stimulating in class and in seminar. I got a great deal out of the old British history professor in his seminar. I don't believe I ever had a lecture course under him. I had a very good instructor, a professor in modern European history. Those were stimulating experiences. They were also good role models for a young professor coming out.
Did you have anything to do with the English department at the time?
No. Maybe unfortunately, no. No, I didn't. No, I... Duke University, I think, mistakenly required me to stick strictly to history. Every course I had was in the field of history.
But
the only association I had outside is I had a foundation in French. Mm-hmm. I could read French, but I couldn't read German, and I had to bring my German. I like to think of my old a PhD degree is a very valid one. I have an old classical AB degree and an old Stern PhD degree where I had to come through with those languages. Uh-huh. And there's no ifs, ands about it.
Right.
And I took those examinations too.
And those examinations in history plus your coursework in history include a lot of essay writing?
Indeed they did. I wrote extensive seminar reports and class essays. Indeed they did.
What about your development, career development after graduate school?
I finished, I was at Duke University less than 2 years for my doctorate. I took my generals in March, I believe, of 1931. And I accepted a job, or got a job, teaching at the University of Tennessee. In that quarter, they had teachers who came in. That was not my first teaching experience. My first teaching experience was in what's now Memphis State University in the summer of 1930. But I taught in that spring quarter at the University of Tennessee. And just by the grace of God, got this appointment here. I was appointed here by the president, not by the Department of History.
At the University of Kentucky.
University of Kentucky. President McVeigh, in his own personal hand, wrote me about my appointment. I came to the University of Kentucky to help develop the library, and also as an instructor in the Department of History. And I think I'll leave that there at that point. I came here, I came out of graduate school thoroughly dedicated to Cleo at Duke University. She was on the library staff. She had graduated from Greenville Woman's College, which is now Furman University.
What was her maiden name?
Turner. Elizabeth Turner. And she went to Simmons College in Boston in library training and got a job in the new Duke University library. And that's where I met her. Graduate students from libraries were thrown into close association. And we were married in 1933, but long after I came here on the staff. These were Depression years that I'm talking about. These were hard years in which you fought like a tiger just to hold on. I don't think people realize how biting and pinching the Great Depression was and what grim futures faced young academicians.
Right.
Things were pretty grim indeed. Right. I know many a time I walked with one or two of my classmates up that long walk going into Duke University, the main drive, worrying our heads off about where we were going to get jobs, where our lives were going to wind up. And sometimes the old kind of straw blew around. There was a job in China that I was approached about applying for that job. Thank God I didn't. And there was an opportunity to go to the Naval Academy. Well, I didn't know anything about naval history, and I was advised against that kind of career, which was good advice. But I came here, as I said a moment ago, thoroughly dedicated to the profession of historian. And I've never turned back on that. I've never had any desire to be anything else but a historian. And I came with a deep appreciation. It was one thing to stand in a class and peddle secondary information. It was an altogether different thing to get out and do some original work yourself. And I had, I suppose, that yin to write. And I did.
Do you think that you felt this way? I know you can't tell how much comes from your own personality and how much doesn't, but did you have professors that felt the same way, who did a lot of original research?
Yes, I had professors who did original research. But like all experiences with academic colleagues, I had a lot of professors who talked a good line, but never delivered much. But I had some who, Sidney, for instance, was a distinguished historian who wrote some landmark books. He would go on living long. Boyd, my major professor in my doctoral work, wrote only one or two books. He never realized his potential. Laprade in British history had written some in the field, of, including a strange textbook in British history. Carroll in modern European history published. He was a dedicated research man. And others that I had were publishing scholars. Here at the University of Kentucky, when I worked on my master's degree, I did not have a single publishing scholar. None of the professors I had published anything.
Which was more typical in those days than now.
That's right. That's right. But it's hard, it's almost impossible to say just exactly what kind of bug bit you, when, and why. But in doing that survey here of literature in this region, I saw so many potentials for writing and research. I still do.
So that project was fortuitous in launching you in your writing career, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yes. I came here with, when I came to Lexington, I already had the bug to write. That experience on that newspaper, student newspaper, and the writing in courses that I had. And then going to graduate school, that is for my doctorate, I wrote a long, dull dissertation.
What was it
on? The building of railroads in the South prior to 1860. I published two books out of it, two small books, The Beginning of the LNN and the Pioneer Southern Railroad. But I lost interest in railroad history almost immediately and turned my interest to thing that I've never departed widely from, the Western movement in American history. I got interested in Kentucky because when I came here, I eventually had to teach Kentucky history, and there was no textbook. And I got busy and prepared a book. I started that book back in the 1931 or 2, 32 I guess, published in 1937. And it's gone through four or five editions, I don't know how many. Out of print now.
What had the professors who taught Kentucky history used prior to your book on
Nothing much. A little elementary book, Kincaid's history. A Cherry's history of Kentucky. Kincaid and Cherry's histories of Kentucky. Which was an insult to the students because they'd had it in the elementary school, and here they were sitting in university classes. with the same little old textbook, which I always thought was an insult to him. And it was bad to write your own textbook and have to teach the course.
Sounds pretty ambitious to me.
Yeah. I got that off, and I also wrote an elementary book, Exploring Kentucky, which was used for many years in elementary school. But my real interest set forth on the collection writing, combination collection writing, of a book that got wonderful reviews and would have had a real good sale had not the paper shortage of World War I killed it dead in its tracks. And that was A Rampaging Frontier. I see that listed in bibliographies all along. And that book went through two or three, maybe four editions. Then I had so many interests back and saw so many things that could be done.
You were how old when your first book was published?
I was 1933. You shouldn't challenge my math. I was 30 years old when I published my first book.
And that was in response to this need for a Kentucky history?
No, that was the
other one, the L&N book. The L&N, okay.
I was 35 years old when the Kentucky history was published.
Before we talk more about your writing, could you tell me a little bit more about your personal life, about marriage, and do you have any children?
I have two children. Mm-hmm. I have a son who I guess I've lived vicariously with him. He's a lawyer and a very successful attorney. He's a senior partner in Stahl Keenan Park. He's a specialist in workman's compensation labor law, which would bore me to death, but excites him. And I have a daughter. My son is a graduate of the University of Rochester in New York, and is a graduate of Duke University Law School. My daughter, Elizabeth Stone, attended Randolph-Macon College for 2 years, a graduate of Duke University, and a graduate of the University of Michigan with a degree in social work. She lives in Bowling Green and is a social worker. She's heads up an agency in Bowling Green. Her husband is a professor of history at Western Kentucky University. I have three grandchildren. I have two grandsons. One is a graduate of Wake Forest College with Phi Beta Kappa, and is entering graduate school at the University of Iowa this fall. The other one is a graduate of Furman University and is in his second year of law at Wake Forest. And my granddaughter has just graduated from the University of North Carolina with an AB degree. And I have one great-grandchild who's not yet in college.
Your son-in-law who teaches history, do you have anything to do with him?
Nothing.
As a student? Or?
No, nothing. His father was president of St. Mary's College in Roland, North Carolina. He's a graduate of the University of North Carolina. Has a PhD degree from University of Tennessee. And he's a professor of history. That's the only job he's had. Oh, I believe he did teach in that community college at Wilmington, North Carolina.
The 20 books, more than 20 books that you've authored and edited, do you have a favorite one?
No, I don't really.
You have a least favorite one, the railroad book?
No, the railroad books, I look on with a great deal of tenderness because they were my first books.
Uh-huh.
I'd do them differently now if I were doing them. But that goes with the trade.
Right.
I enjoyed doing the river book, which had marvelous reviews, and it's coming back into print. It's going to be republished. I certainly Pills, Petticoats, and Plows, which is going to, I don't know how many editions, it's still in print.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll go to my grave with people remembering that about as much as anything I've ever done. Of course, my big book, Frontier America, I'm glad I did. The Emerging South, I caught that book, I did that book just at that feverish moment after Brown versus
Board of Education.
Board of Education. Mm-hmm. And Kentucky Land of Contrast, I think, is a book that I will never be sorry I did. And, oh, you don't have favorites. You do these books and you've got a, it's like a woman who's in a constant state of pregnancy. You get rid of one and there's another one in the womb.
Which was your most difficult book to do?
That's a question I've never been asked and one I never had thought about.
Maybe they were difficult in different ways.
It took me a long time on Frontier America because I had to cover such a vast geographical area and sift through such an enormous amount of material.
Mm-hmm.
That was difficult and it was time consuming and challenging because you were working on a much broader scale. Physically, I spent an awful lot of time on the Rampaging Frontier because I had to copy all of that material out of that fine print in many cases. Out of magazines and
mm-hmm.
I suppose physically, Pills, Petticoats, and Plows, I spent a solid year just gathering, physically, packing just thousands of records.
And right.
This fine collection that's here in the University of Kentucky Library, mm-hmm. result of that. Certainly I spent an awful lot of time on Southern Country Editor. Oh, I don't know. I never had thought about that.
Doing this in the days before photocopying made
right.
things so much easier.
All of it by hand. I want to mention something that I did and I think will outlive me. Hope it will. I edited that 6-volume Southern Travels, which I think I can say with some modesty is an important work.
Yes.
The University of Oklahoma Press agreed to publish that. The Rockefeller Foundation gave us some seed money, and I spent one well a lot of time on that. A lot of creative editing in that 6-volume work. I think a lot of people think of my writing, they don't realize that that book is there.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, a back-breaking job. Oh, my Lord, an enormous, challenging job was that 4-volume History of Indiana University.
Mm, yes.
That big work. And I must not have done a good job on that because I have yet to have had a complaint about it. I know there's something wrong with it.
I doubt it. Is there a book you would like to have written but haven't?
Oh, yes. Yes, sirree, there's a book I would have liked to have written.
What would that be?
That is a big book. I would have liked to have written a big book in American history. And a seminal book. I think I would have liked to have written a book that would have been a landmark national book.
What would the subject be?
An unnamed subject, really. But a book that would have had a tremendous national impact. I would have liked to have written a book, for instance, of the scope and stature of Dumont Malone's Jefferson. I would have liked to have written a book of the stature of Phillips, life and labor in the Old South. Or a biography of the distinction of Bob Remini's Andrew Jackson. Oh, you could go on. But
is there a particular character you might have wanted to write about in history and have it?
I think I could have been very compatible with Jackson. Not that I'm a Jacksonian in philosophy. I could have been compatible with a man like Henry Clay, for instance. Or I turned down an invitation to write a biography of Cassius Clay because a publisher asked me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Simply because I couldn't quite see what Cassius Clay amounted to after all. You had to justify the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And I philosophically would have had a hard time doing that. I was invited by a publisher to write a biography of Cordell Hull, which would have required me to do an awful lot of familiarizing myself with foreign relations,
yeah,
which I had no background in, and which would have involved me so deeply that I wondered if I was capable, really, of doing that. Yet a lot of Cordell Hull's life would have been very fascinating. I think I would have liked to have written a biography of Barclay. Alvin Barclay, yes.
Yeah.
And I still have in my crawl a biography of George Prentice, if I live long enough.
Mm. When you write your books or the books you've written, who are you primarily writing for, historians or lay people or both?
Never for historians. I stayed away from that. Mm-hmm. That's an abomination in the sight of God. Historians writing for historians. That's digging corpses up out of one grave and burying them in another. No, I have an interested reader in mind. In my writing, I've always seen some faces across the typewriter, just ordinary people.
So you have an audience in mind of students,
right,
or?
I think a historian has an obligation, not to his profession. If you're writing a professional book, like compiling a professional book, like Travels in the Old South, you do have a lot of people there in mind. Users of all sorts, seekers after information there. But in writing Pills, Petticoats, and Plows, I had two people in mind. I had the person who had a sentimental, emotional, view of the rural South, mm-hmm. and I also had in mind a very important chapter in Southern development, and that is that old furnishing system that sustained the Southern agrarian system and Southern society after the Civil War. In the Southern Country Editor, there's a new edition of that book coming. I had in mind the influence of the editor on the development of the Southern mind and the Southern reaction to political issues, economic issues, the source of information, the source of entertainment, the development of viewpoints of the Southern population. And I was writing back to those people. I was writing back to the readers who, again, were agrarian, rural oriented. Mm-hmm. And if the historians found them useful, so be it. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't writing to the historians.
But it
a lot of historians do write to historians.
So it must be a difficult balance to write for the layperson, be entertaining enough to
keep your professional integrity.
Right, intact. Right, right.
I've never been unmindful of that fact.
Yeah.
In the River book, that was thorough joy. That was real joy. Yeah. I just loosened my belt and unbuttoned my shirt and wrote.
Right.
And that's pretty much true in Kentucky Land of Contrast. Although I was following a theme that is a major theme in Kentucky, that is the sectional divisiveness of the state. And the social and political, economic factors.
Right. Are you working on any writing projects now? Do you have any plan for the future?
Right now, up to my eyeballs in this editing of the Bradford Notes with a deadline that would kill a mule.
Did you talk a little bit about that project?
In 1826, John Bradford, first editor, first newspaper man in Kentucky, publisher of the Kentucky Gazette, which came out August 11, 1787, was also a pioneer. He was very actively engaged in many of the events in the Kentucky development from 1775 down to the time of his death in 1830. He was an active participant, an active viewer of the scene. And certainly as a newspaper editor, he was a very active viewer, but he had been a land surveyor, he had been a soldier. Mm-hmm. He had been into all kinds of political things. He was chairman of the Board of Trustees of the town of Lexington, who welcomed Isaac Shelby to Lexington when Shelby became governor, first governor of Kentucky, and they organized state government here. I'm sure without having documentary proof of it, and I doubt that's available or ever was available, I'm sure that Bradford read Jefferson's Notes on Virginia. I'm sure he was influenced by those notes. Mm-hmm. There's just too much internal evidence of that fact. He started in September of 1826 publishing notes in the Kentucky Gazette. He had resumed editorship of that paper. And almost every issue, or in many issues. He published sometimes a column and a half of reminiscent or historical material. Sometimes he quoted from documents. Sometimes he quoted from notes that people had given him. He says that he had at hand a great many notes. He had Marshall's History of Kentucky and Filson's History, which is just about the only published sources he had available. He gives a good insight in those notes into the almost day-by-day progression of the Anglo-American settlement of this region. Mm-hmm. And of that monstrous Indian conflict. He's almost obsessed with the Indian conflict. And that requires a great deal of looking into corroborating sources, not original sources for Bradford, but corroborative sources to see that Bradford is on track with his information. He was obsessed with the idea that the future generations would not appreciate the hardships of the pioneers. And Boone, Kenton, all those people that contributed to the Draper manuscripts, the Draper sources of information, were obsessed with the idea that future generations would not appreciate their monumental accomplishments. And that thread runs throughout. And I'm getting that ready for publication in the bicentennial year.
This is for University of Kentucky Press.
That's right.
And it will be the notes edited?
Edited, that's right, with an essay.
I see.
An explanatory essay.
And
one thing I've done, I have been involved heavily in the production of this encyclopedia of Kentucky history, contributing some 80-some-odd articles, and writing the overview article for that. Mm-hmm. That was a monumental writing task itself.
Yes.
On Sunday morning, if I'm still around on that day, I'll be 88 years old. And an 88-year-old man doesn't even buy green bananas. he can dream of doing another book, but getting it done is another matter.
Well, is there one that you would have planned after this
project? I plan to go on with The Apprentice, if there's anything left of me.
What do you get out of writing that you don't get out of teaching?
God knows what you get out of writing.
Other than a publication.
There's something. There's a mean wench in your life when you become a writer. I think this must be generally true of every writer, that you never quite reach that point of satisfaction. You're always dissatisfied with what you've done. Mm-hmm. You've never reached, maybe there is no such thing as soul satisfaction.
Yeah.
There's always a feeling of inadequacy.
What about
and when? And I've been dogged mightily by that feeling.
What about when you reread books that you've wrote years ago? Are you able to read them objectively now?
Yes.
And aren't you pleased as well as disappointed, maybe?
You have two reactions to your own books. One is, I wish I could do that over again. But when you say that, you must remember that several other books have gone under the bridge also, and you've matured in perspective, and you certainly new sources of information have come along,
right,
have been uncovered, and are now available, which were not available to you. My history of Kentucky, for instance. Look at the slender resources I had in 31 compared with the resources you have now.
Right.
State archives have been developed. The State Historical Society has improved its collection enormously.
Right.
The Filson Club has grown. The University of Kentucky at the time I started could not have supported the writing of a chapter, let alone a book. Or look at that special collections now, enormously important,
right,
not in existence. Look at the books that have been published since then. Biographies of Boone, biographies of Benjamin Logan, biographies of Simon Kenton, for instance, or
right,
or the special books, open broad vistas,
sure,
that were not then available to you.
Well, if you were asked to redo that book now, how would you do it?
I'd do it in a multi-volume series, and I would approach it with new viewpoints of the meaning of the westward movement, expansion into this region.
Have you changed some of your points of view then?
Yes, I have. Yes, I have. I hope I've grown intellectually over these years. Yes, I would. I would change.
What ideas have you changed?
I would look at the Kentucky political system with a great deal more maturity, I think, than I had then, and a great deal more understanding. I would look at the development of constitutional government with some new perspective. I would look at the role of women, for instance. I'm not a feminist, and I think we're taking that business of being damn fools in some of the things that we're doing in the feminist. We go to extremes in these things. Women were enormously important. There were pioneer women who made major contributions. There were women all along the line. The state couldn't have existed without the contribution of women. But I would treat them in the context of Kentuckians,
mm-hmm,
of the collective society. And I would look at slavery differently. I would look at the contribution of blacks differently, but not segregating them and treating them as an unrelated part to the whole. They were part of the whole structure. And I would try to treat them as they fitted into that.
So you're saying that you believe a lot of the movements now, ostensibly to gain equality, actually segregate more.
I think so. I think as I read these modern works and see these reactions, we are faddist, and I think we're creating a segregated extreme. On the other hand, mm-hmm, where we didn't treat those things as fully in the past as we should have, we're going to the extreme on the other hand. I've always thought there was a sensible middle ground on which to stand. I would not want to be interpreted in this interview as being anti-feminist or racist, because I certainly am not.
No,
I used to say to my classes, young women, that one of you can make a whale of a reputation if you'll get busy and write a good book on women. And doing this editing of these Bradford notes, I come on so many references, mm-hmm, to the role of women. The pioneering movement never could have succeeded without women.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that very conscientiously.
Right.
And I hope from the perspective of basic source knowledge,
right,
of that. But I'm not an extremist.
Right.
I've always been, I hope, a middle ground. I'm not any Indian. The Indians had a point of view, and that's one thing I have to deal with in this Bradford thing, is that We wrote the history, but the Indians had a point of view, uh-huh. and it definitely must be presented.
Right.
And I'm going to try honestly and faithfully as I can. It's hard to be objective.
Sure.
That's the greatest challenge that a writer of history faces, I think, is being objective, being comprehensive and objective.